Welcome to the program for Friday, November 9th, 2012 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's Friday, so it's the Federal News Countdown. And this week, the two experts counting down their choices for the three most important federal news stories of the week are Mark Forman, president and co-founder of Government Transaction Services, Inc. Mark, it's great to have you in the studio. Good to, thanks for coming in today.
And a beautiful day to be here.
It is indeed. It's a little chilly to do the show outside, so we'll be in the studio for the entire hour today. And Stan Soloway, president and CEO of the Professional Services Council. Stan, it's always good to have you on,
always
as always.
Always good to be here, Francis. So I think it's colder in the studio than it is outside.
Well, I do that because, you know, when three of us get in this studio, it's not very big, and after a while,
all the hot air.
That's exactly right. The Federal News Countdown is a program where each of you have chosen your three most important federal news stories of the week, ranked them in order from number three to number one. And, of course, we always start with
number three.
Stan Soloway, your third most important federal news story of the week is titled Four More Years, Obama's Reelection Impact on Federal IT. It's from FedScoop. And I started the show with neglecting to mention that since – there really is not anything else going on in Washington besides the election this week. That's been what everybody's been thinking about and talking about and so on. So, Stan, it was your great idea to just focus just on the election this week. So this is kind of a special edition. Your number three story, the focus on IT, it may be one of the areas where we see some budget growth despite what else is going on with the budget.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting article. I guess my only point here was that everybody's asking the question, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the management agenda and so forth later in the show, I think. But everybody asks the question, and my answer is I'm not sure it mattered who got elected in the sense that IT is the core of everything the government's doing. There's still a lot of work to get done. It's going to depend largely on kind of who's in what roles. I've already seen a couple of CIO shifts around over the last few days. But it's clearly an area that I think you'll see growth, and you'll see it modest, but it'll be there. And there would be a lot of pressure kept up on it. It's also going to be an area that I think highlights what sort of in an ancillary basis, I think is a huge challenge. It's not the fiscal challenge. It's the human capital challenge. I mean, the government is really, really got a problem right now. The economy's coming back slowly, albeit, but the technology base is doing pretty well. There's a tremendous shortage of talent. The government is not competing well. And when I look at this and I think about, or we think about, the role IT played, I mean, Mark did this, he ran this in a previous administration, he knows it better than anybody. I then think about, well, who's going to be there to do it? And so you think about the federal workforce generally, which is slightly greater than the average general economy. It's about four times as many people over 50 as under 30. And the federal IT workforce, according to the Office of Personnel Management, the ratio is 7-1. Seven times as many people over 50 as under 30, which is exactly the reverse of what you see in the general economy and in the commercial sector. And I think that the focus on IT is not going to stop. But now how do you balance that against a continued real struggle and the coming retirement wave in the technology base?
Mark, when you look at that and you hear those numbers, and this is something you've been passionate about since you've been on the Hill, what turns that around? Is there some event? Is there some initiative? Is there something that turns that around and draws young people to work in an IT in the government?
Well, I think the reason that we're not going to see that tremendous influx of IT in the government is because of the way the government buys IT and what they want to use it for. Now, I think the future is bright for anybody, whether you're in the private sector doing IT or in the government. And of course, remember, the statistics I got when I was at OMB, about 1 million people working in government IT, federal IT. About 85% are in the contractor community, and about 15%, so you know, well over 100,000 in the government at that point. I don't think that you would ever see a scenario of even 50% of the federal workforce in IT being government employees. It's not doable when you're talking about the magnitude of people that the government needs to support them in IT. So Cobb's paradox rules. And for me, today's version of Cobb's paradox is people want to buy client server applications and business processes because it locks in the funding stream for many years. It's a capital investment. And there's part of the budget game this year is locking in a funding stream. And I think everybody who's worked in government understands that. Now, as Stan was saying, you look in the commercial IT, that's an anathema. Nobody does that in the commercial world. Everything's about agility, being able to move to the next big project, the next big application of the technology. It's very much a horizontal as opposed to a vertical siloed approach. So, you know, the government's going to continue to spend. That's good whether you're in the federal employment or whether you're in the contractor community. But the government's going to have to take advantage of these horizontal IT expenditures. That's going to pull the young people in, and I think it's fine if they come in by a contractor.
You know, there's one other point to this. It's, again, another ancillary piece of it, but I think it also, if you look at the demography of the workforce and the challenges that Mark's talking about, which is somewhat driven by the demography and sort of the who's there, and the fact that the government's not going to compete well for large numbers of you, it really requires you to step back and rethink some of the efforts that are being made on the acquisition side to do things like, say, we're not going to have contractors in a pre-award environment. You may have no choice. And I'm not saying this to be self-serving for our community, but you may have no choice if you want to get new thinking and an understanding of how to integrate and apply it to actually rethink that question and say, well, maybe that's what I get. Because that's what they do in the commercial world. They bring in outside experts to help them figure out what they need.
Stan Soloway's third most important federal news story of the week is from FedScoop. The headline is 4 More Years, Obama's Reelection Impact on Federal IT. It's posted now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Mark Forman, your third most important story of the week is from Yahoo News. The headline, and through them, the Christian Science Monitor. And the headline is, after Obama wins, say goodbye to neocons. And then the subhead is, at least for a few years. Always a caveat there when it comes to completely eliminating one particular group or another out of political stuff, isn't it?
Well, you know, we've been through this fascinating time. I originally, the first half of my career was all in defense, and my background's operations research. So, growing up and spending a lot of time both in the defense community and on the Hill, you see the whole group of what was probably thousands of folks that all came into government, be that on the Hill, Republican, Democrat, I don't think mattered as much. But the notion that America is the power after the Cold War. And how do we use that power? I think this election spoke a lot. The country's tired of war. There were a lot of discussions about what do we use with the peace dividend. There is no peace dividend. A key part of the policy question that this article relates to is the fact that the Defense Department is not going to have as many resources. It's not going to have as big a role. And there are huge implications in terms of allocation of the budget, adjusting the budget for many years to come, as well as our foreign policy elements. And so this is a major policy shift that's going to have, I think, a dramatic role in the equation of balancing the budget.
Stan, I see three schools of thought kind of forming around what Mark is talking about. One of them is formulation of strategy and then formulation of budget to fit the strategy. Formulation of budget and then formulation of strategy to fit the budget, and then the concept you have to do both of them at the same time. Do you fall into one or another of those, and which do you think is likely to win the day?
Yeah, I think you parsed it well, and Secretary Panetta and others have said the new defense strategy has driven the defense budget, and a lot of us looked at that and said, well, that may be, but the budget was established before you had the strategy because we had the Budget Control Act of a year ago. And so, you know, budget's been driving strategy for a little bit of time. I think to some extent it's going to, because everybody realizes there is this constrained resource. Where I might be have a little bit different view than Mark is, you know, I did see this article, and my first reaction was, this is the Christian Science Monitor, and this is something they've been preaching for a long time, and so it was a little bit of a victory lap, by the Monitor. But whether you agree or disagree, I think Mark's absolutely correct that the budget environment could dramatically affect how we engage and project overseas through whatever department. I think it's a bit of a stretch, and I'm not being critical, Mark. I think it's a bit of a stretch to say the election drove that. I think it's the budget, because plenty of folks who are in favor of cutting the defense budget also want to cut foreign aid. Whereas if you look at the Obama administration, they don't want to cut foreign aid. In fact, there are a number of Republicans who don't want to cut foreign aid. So I think it's more the budget issues. I think Mark's absolutely right. The public is very clearly war weary. That was very evident in all the polls. And so there was that push. But if there's another attack, I think you'll see that turn fairly quickly. And it's not clear that the defense issues and the foreign policy issues really, at the end of the day, played in this election very heavily in terms of an underlying philosophy. I think the public still struggles with that. I sometimes fear we're headed towards a full isolationism. People want to cut defense, never intervene, and also cut foreign aid, never do that because we need the money at home. So I'm not sure we've settled that one out.
I think you're right that it will potentially turn quickly, and I think the sentiment can turn more quickly than Congress or the executive branch can respond to it.
And that's the fear with the new strategy. Some people have said, how agile is the strategy should we have a change of circumstance?
Mark Forman's third most important federal news story of the week is from the Christian Science Monitor through Yahoo News. The headline is, after Obama win, say goodbye to neocons. When we come back, the second most important federal news story of the week from Mark Forman and Stan Soloway on this week's Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The GW Colonials pay tribute to the people who raise high our community. The Washington area soldiers, police officers, firefighters, EMS personnel, teachers, and public servants for Local Heroes Day. When GW takes on Hofstra Saturday, November 24th at 2 p.m. at the Charles E. Smith Center. If you're one of the men and women who serve, call 202-994-7325 to order special discounted tickets. All other fans can visit gwsports.com/tickets to join them to raise high the buff and blue.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
Hey, federal employees. Choose the plan we believe is altogether better for your health. Kaiser Permanente. Get the inside story on better care. Join a Kaiser Permanente physician for a complimentary Fed webinar scheduled most Wednesdays through December 5th. Go to kp.org/midatlantic to register for a webinar on Kaiser Permanente federal benefits. That's kp.org/midatlantic. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States, Inc., 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
The job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview.
Yeah.
And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Here's Lawrence Hale, Director of Center for Strategic Solutions and Services, GSA FAS, on the Federal Executive Forum on Identity Management, Progress, and Best Practices, sponsored by Quest Software by Dell.
There are opportunities such as the Cloud Identity Exchange, which is vital to accessing critical applications through the cloud with solid identity management. So we work with NIST, with the NSTIC, to promote those standards to help things like the Cloud Identity Exchange become reality.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Quest Software IT Management Solutions help you lower costs, manage risk, extend platform capability and lifecycle, and reduce the complexity of IT management. They make your mission possible, physical, virtual, and in the cloud. Quest Software is simplicity at work, and it's available through DLT Solutions. Simplify. Thrive. Quest Software. Learn more at DLT.com/mission possible. That's DLT.com/mission possible.
Foreign students have just left Washington with new public relations skills, courtesy of the Defense Department. I'm Emily Coppa. Monday's Federal Drive will talk with Defense Information School Commandant Jeremy Martin about why his latest graduates are members of other militaries. Lots more, too, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
This just in to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're learning this afternoon at Federal News Radio and federalnewsradio.com that David Petraeus is resigning as Director of Central Intelligence after admitting that he has had an extramarital affair. According to his letter of resignation, Petraeus asks President Obama on Thursday to allow him to resign and President Obama accepting that resignation today. Petraeus said in a statement that he's shown extremely poor judgment in having an affair. James Clapper, director of the Office of National Intelligence, issuing this statement. Today, CIA Director David Petraeus submitted his letter of resignation to the president. Dave's decision to step down represents the loss of one of our nation's most respected public servants. From his long, illustrious Army career to his leadership at the helm of CIA, Dave has redefined what it means to serve and sacrifice for one's country. And more kind words from James Clapper, the director of the Office of National Intelligence, responding to the resignation of David Petraeus as director of Central Intelligence. We have more details, including the full text of Mr. Clapper's statement, posted now on federalnewsradio.com. And my guests on the Federal News Countdown are here to also talk about this breaking news this afternoon on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Stan Soloway and Mark Forman. And Mark, the reaction that we had as we received this message just during the last commercial break, I thought was fascinating and actually folds in and fits with the story that you've selected as the second most important this week, having to do with what President Obama's second term might look like.
Right. Well, there's always the desire to have the management agenda stay the same. And my second article, Jason Miller's article about minor tweaks in the Obama second term, is always the desire. Stan and I were talking before. I was a first termer. Stan was a second termer. And the reality is the people change. And you cannot maintain, whether you're in industry or government, management initiatives with changes in leadership. And as we see today, you know, this is an unfortunate event. The poor guy probably lost his security clearance and a judgment error. That said, you look at the leadership in the State Department now. Who knows what will happen with Clapper? Perhaps leadership at the Defense Department. Clearly, there have been long-term leadership gaps in the White House that affects so many of the policy and policy to budget alignment issues. And you realize that as much as you want to hold the management policy or the agenda, on public policy the same, you can't. The people are going to change. They're going to have their own ideas. We want them to bring good things to the government. Changes are coming.
And whether we like it or not, an issue like this, I'm sure, was not something that the administration was counting on, Stan.
Yeah, I have to say, and I say this as a Democrat, I'm kind of wondering how they kept this under the rug until after the election, because these things don't just happen overnight.
Uh-huh.
That's the CIA. You know, it's
you
a secret.
Don't think it was a celebratory party?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think Mark's point is right on target, although I'm not sure it's impossible to maintain the momentum. It often depends on the kind of people who come in behind it, and it's more complicated than do you agree with what was being done, but do you have the same degree of passion for the path that the predecessor was on? And so I would argue that, for instance, at the Defense Department, when Jack Gansler came in behind Paul Kaminsky, he had the same degree of passion around acquisition and acquisition reform as Kaminsky. So it wasn't that we didn't change and refocus, reprioritize, but the pressure was still there. I think for this administration, that question is going to exist as Jeff Zients stay. Because he was, before he became the acting director, of course, he was the deputy and in charge of performance measurement. Shelley Metzenbaum. There's a number of key players around the management agenda. Steve Van Roekel is the CIO. If there are a number of shifts and there are different people who want to maybe try, as Mark said, they're going to have their own path and you want some new ideas. But this is also one of the weaknesses. I think that Mark says in the private sector, when leadership change, you can't maintain these initiatives. But really good organizations find a way to cement one set and move into the next one. We have a tendency to sort of zigzag, and that's where you'll hear from the workforce. Oh, now we're going right. We're going to tack left. Now we're going to tack up. We're going to tack down. In a good institution, a university, a company, whatever, somehow you maintain some degree of consistency even as you change direction a little.
Well, one of the critical things about that, Mark, and something you and I have talked about before about some of the initiatives that you installed when you ran eGov at OMB, is how do you make them stick? And that's what it sounds like Stan is getting to, is when you have a system that you really believe is effective, how do you institute that in such a way that it becomes the policy and prevents the shifting right to left, as he alluded to?
Right, and that gets into the governance structure. Now, government works by regulations and laws. One of the things that I think has to be part of this discussion is a change in leadership of key committees in the Congress. So, for example, you know, I'm a big fan of the concept of smart lean government, the use of basically artifacts from enterprise architecture, your business architecture, your performance architecture, the data you have on performance of the operations, to consolidate all these redundant programs that have grown up over the years and really focus on how do we do the best job in a policy here. The father of that over the last 5 years or so on in the Congress has been Senator Coburn. You know, to the extent that Congress passed a law, he was the lead on it to have GAO do the redundancy, annual redundancy report, and then the appropriators feeling that they were the target of the redundancy and clearly are part of the issue there, cutting GAO's budget so they wouldn't do a good job on the report. This is, I think, one of the major areas of change. Not saying that we'll get anything in the near term out of that, but there's no question. Senator Collins perhaps moving on and Coburn taking over on the Republican side. Senator Carper, and you know I worked for Bill Roth from Delaware. Delaware is a net payer state. Government reform is an issue in Delaware. It's not in many states or many elections. So I think that's one of the biggest things to watch in terms of the management policy and the impact on federal employees.
The situation, Stan, with General Petraeus is unfortunate, and as he said himself, it's a judgment issue. A lot of the changes that we'll be talking about over the next several months aren't. It's simply an issue where someone believes that he or she has done all they can do, and it's time to move on to a different position. One of the things that I think is funny is going around to the various sources and seeing the different people that folks are prognosticating will take these different jobs. Does anybody know this any better than the people that choose stocks and you go back and you look and 99% of them have underperformed the market over the last however many years? Is this just a big parlor game?
Or is there something to it? Well, it's both. It's a parlor game and sometimes there's something to it, particularly in a second term when you have people sort of lined up and there's some folks. But you're right in that sense that this, unlike the unfortunate situation with General Petraeus, there are a lot of people will make decisions at the pressure, the hours or whatever, it's time to move on and do something different. The only thing I want to add to what Mark said, having been a second termer, is I remember when we were at the Pentagon, the folks from GAO coming to me because I was running the Defense Reform Office, and they said, you realize when you guys leave, this all collapses. There's nothing there. And I said, well, what would your recommendation be? And they said, metrics. You don't have long-term metrics. And so we invested a lot. We worked with GAO on metrics for all the major reforms. It's still, some of them held, some of them didn't, because at the end of the day, I think it's less difficult, as much as change will happen, to maintain some momentum within an administration. But anytime you change the owner of the White House, remember, Mark will remember this, in 2000, the Bush administration required that the word reform be taken off all websites because we're no longer talking about reforming. You get those radical shifts. But the area where I've, and Mark's the expert in this, but where I think we've seen the most consistency across administrations and across within administrations, the terms, has been in the e-gov and IT space. It's been almost a natural progression of initiatives. Now, we haven't fully fulfilled many of the initiatives, and we sometimes layer on top or repackage old ideas, but it's the one area where you see a little bit more consistency than you see, for instance, an acquisition where I often despair about how much we backslid, or in other areas. I sometimes think that the e-gov area, the IT area, is one that's actually been a good example of continuity.
We got to take a break, but Stan, we'll continue this conversation in just a moment because your second most important federal news story of the week is along the same lines. Mark, your second choice is Jason Miller's column on a story on federalnewsradio.com. Headline, Fed should expect minor tweaks in Obama's second term. All the stories that we're counting down on the program today are posted now on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and the Federal News Countdown continues in just a moment.
We think federal employees deserve a big
extra
thanks for all their hard work. That's why at the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Service Benefit Plan, we've added benefits at no added cost, from free well child care to free immunizations. After all, you've earned them. No wonder more federal employees choose Blue Cross and Blue Shield than any other coverage. To learn more, call 1-800-411-BLUE or visit
extras.fepblue.org.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government,
Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Genetics and teen obesity. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Is it possible we can be born into obesity? Not completely, but genetics can play a role. But new research shows that those at risk of obesity because of genetics and hereditary factors can reduce that underlying risk with exercise. Andrea Richardson is at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Our study has shown that achieving the recommended level of moderate to vigorous physical activity can reduce the genetic effect for higher BMI among teens. This is important because adolescents are at high risk for weight gain that can then lead to later adult obesity and severe obesity.
Richardson noted that the heritability of obesity is estimated to be between 40% and 70%. The study presented at a meeting of the Obesity Society was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
Human capital management for the federal government is the most anticipated training event this year, featuring more than 30 participating federal human chief capital officers and chief learning officers. Don't miss this year's event, to be held on November 28th through the 30th, 2012, at the Sheraton Pentagon City Hotel in Arlington, Virginia. Check out the website, www.hcmfederal.com, for more information and to register now. Mention code HCMF for a $200 discount.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on this week's Federal News Countdown, Mark Forman and Stan Soloway, up to number two on the countdown. And Stan, your second most important federal news story of the week kind of fits with Mark's. Yours is from GovExec. It's Charles Clark's story, Obama's Victory Gives Management Reformers Breathing Room. You were talking a moment ago about some of the things that you expect to see management-wise, but what... Is reformers even the right word to use when you have a continuity of administration? Not a reflection on the politics of it, just on the fact that essentially the overall strategy is coming from the top of the White House should be consistent, one would think.
Yeah, you can use reform for only so long, and then you get into sort of sustainment and continuity. But and I think this article is very similar to the one, obviously, that Mark pulled. I just didn't want to kiss up to you guys and use Jason's article. But it's a very similar point in that I think what Charlie Clark's point in here is that assuming we can avoid this fiscal crisis, then there may be some progress made on the management reforms. And it comes back very much to the point that Mark was raising, is a lot of it will depend on who's there and what the leadership decides they're going to really push and continue to push. This clearly, you would think, in a time of fiscal crisis and austerity, this stuff has got to be top of the heap because there's all kinds of incredible efficiencies that could be driven at a time when you need to find every opportunity to save. If sequestration happens, you know, all bets are off. But I think the other piece here gets back to not just who's in the leadership, but as we look at what does even performance measurement, performance management, and the tech stat and all these other elements – mean and what does it require? I want to come back to what I started with earlier in the show, and that is, do you have the right people to execute? A lot of good ideas, a lot of good strategy, but do we have people in place who actually can execute and have the authority to use the information they generate through some of these processes to change things? And sometimes that's where you really get into a rub.
It strikes me that one of the places where that's going to have to really be a close eye is going to have to be is your former agency, OMB, because we have an acting director. We have a bunch of acting people there and a bunch of capacities that are really important.
But, you know, Jason's article highlights, of course, he doesn't come out and say it, but a management philosophy that does not have a significant role for OMB in management reform. The concept is centralized policy, decentralized execution. That's the management philosophy of this administration. And to the extent that doesn't change, we're back to the scenario of the early 90s where any reform energy comes from the Hill, which is fine. Now, I don't think that you can do budgetary reform without management reform. The government is an unusual place where we built a lot of energy. Certainly, I was very fortunate to tap into the core group or create a core group of career reformers, and they're there. I mean, there are thousands of folks. And you know, we all went through that. You, when you're young and you come into your first few jobs, you see things that aren't done right. You know they're not done right, and you're not wedded to the system. You're relatively new. And what I saw over the last few months for the first time, these reformers are getting beaten up. People tell me it's by their CFOs. There's just no energy, no resources going into that. So I associate that with the decentralized execution. Of course, you know, you referred to OMB. I was fascinated by the budget memos, the A11 guidance, which basically said, hey, we've been giving you guys all these memos. How come you're not doing it? And every one of those memos say, oh, by the way, it's up to you to decide whether you want to do it. This is, I agree with Stan, it's so critical to understand the people coming into the agencies. But you got to watch Congress and see what's happening with the appropriators and the key authorizing committees. And you got to watch these new people come in to understand the management reform.
And Mark's hit it right on the head, and there's one other piece to this. And you said you can't have budget reform without management reform, but you can have budget cuts without management reform, and that's the danger that you will do that.
Yes.
The second piece is, we talk about Congress. Tom Carper has a major IT reform bill that he's been working on. It's fairly significant. It's the next phase of Mark Foreman's bill, which we call Foreman Klinger Cohen.
Paul Brubaker again. Folks,
Foreman Brubaker Klinger Cohen.
I think I'm going to start to call it that.
Don't
call
like Paul Brubaker.
David Bloker.
So there's this major legislation on the Hill. I think one of the questions is, to what degree is the administration partnering with the Hill on this and making it a collective effort so that's not something just presented? And if you go back to the 90s with the acquisition bills or with Klinger-Cohen, there was a substantial amount of administration
Absolutely.
Involvement and administration partnering, and it was a very collaborative process, which gave it tremendous energy. The last thing is, Mark just made a comment, and I'll just leave it at this, is what he's talking about in terms of I'll call the burnout of reformers and the lack of them getting beat up by CFOs. We see this in lots of elements of the workforce. The acquisition community has been at the heck beaten out of them. We'll be having our biannual acquisition policy survey, will be out in a few weeks. And one thing that's very clear is innovation, creativity is sought after by leadership but rarely supported when it goes south, and that's going to drive a workforce away faster than anything else.
I think I'll start calling it Foreman Brubaker Chenock Klinger Cohen. How does that sound?
Yeah, well, Chenock will get mad that he's not the front.
Yeah,
well.
Chenock is part of the EGOV Act, and you know, similarly.
But I just wanted to get his name in there.
Well, I appreciate that. Dan's a great guy. Very high Dan. And you got to put Greenwald's name in there,
oh, yeah.
too.
It's going to just get longer and longer.
That's right. But you know, that's right. People may not remember, the EGOV Act originally was Senator Lieberman's bill. And you're right, whether it was FASA, Klinger-Cohn, FARA, the CFO Act, the EGOV Act, the best and most transformational legislation occurs when the executive branch partners with the Congress on these management laws.
Stan Soloway, second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. It's headlined, Obama's Victory Gives Management Reformers Breathing Room. And you can read it and all of the stories we're counting down today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're up to number one, the most important federal news stories of the week. Election style is chosen by Stan Soloway and Mark Foreman. Next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
APWU Health Plan, your healthcare companion, features comprehensive benefits and Cigna's nationwide network of more than 1 million provider locations. It makes finding the right network provider so simple. Also, APWU Health Plan's diabetes management program saves members more than $150 a month. Learn more at APWUHP.com or call 800-PIC-APWU, your healthcare companion.
The U.S. Postal Service is an agency in transition. Despite consolidation and multiple rounds of buyouts, USPS still has massive debt. Federal News Radio's November Agency of the Month program examines how USPS intends to get back on solid financial footing. In an exclusive interview, Postmaster General Patrick Donahue explains why it's critical Congress pass postal reform legislation. Find it at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency of the Month.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
The Agriculture Department has helped distribute more than 1 million pounds of food to victims and temporarily eased rules on food stamps. Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Kevin Concannon.
In places like New York, for example, we have provided the authority to reissue the portion of benefits that food stamp recipients received for last month on the basis that a number of those households, their food was destroyed.
FederalNewsRadio.com/FederalDrive.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Federal News Countdown, featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week. Selected this week by Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Mark Foreman of Government Transaction Services. And we're up to
number one.
Mark Foreman, your choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is Vote Data Show Changing Nation. And this is apparently was a big surprise to the Romney campaign and was not such a big surprise to the Obama campaign, it appears.
That's right. Now, I look at it more from a public policy standpoint, but, this is not about Democratic or Republican. This is about the changing key sectors of the economy. You know, a lot of people look at numbers such as the dramatic growth in food stamps, and maybe that's an indicator. I don't know. But we've known for years that we're having a lot more people retire, and because of what's happened in the financial situation, those retirement nest eggs aren't as good. We know that there are going to be huge impacts on the future of Medicare and Medicaid. We know the demographics in terms of much more significant Latino population, and that they operate now as not just Republicans and Democrats, but there are unique needs and policy requirements. So, you know, we're seeing just, I think, the edge of a major rewrite of what are the major policy initiatives and policy areas that the country needs. It's going to reshape the political parties. I don't believe they're the leading indicators. They're a lagging indicator. But we are going to need different policies. And debates that we have been having in this election, I think, largely were irrelevant to the key needs in the electorate, these new demographic groups.
But what Mark is saying that I agree with the most there, Stan, is the idea that what got discussed in the presidential campaign was nowhere near the consequential conversations and debates that have to happen when it comes to governing this country, not just for this year or next year, but for 10 and 20 and 30 years and the country that we hand to my son, who's 12 right now.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100%. I mean, Kathleen Parker had a great piece in the Washington Post the other day about the election. And basically, she said, I think her headline was, "The election debased us as a people," because her point was, both candidates. She was putting, you know, pox on both your houses for the lack of substance and so forth. And I think there's a number of pieces here. There was a statistic I saw the other day to buttress what Mark was saying that said that when Ronald Reagan was elected in his landslide and he won 40 states, he had 67% of the white male vote. Mitt Romney had 63% of the white male vote, so less, but not a dramatic amount less, and, you know, wasn't even in the game. Mm-hmm. And that just shows you how this demographic shift has happened. And you can look at it old versus young, over 40 versus under 40. I mean, there's a lot of splits here. What we run the risk of, and I think Mark was sort of alluding to this, I fully agree with him, is overanalyzing the results. We had what people said was a wave election in 2010. Then we had a different election than a lot of people thought. To me, the biggest thing, and it will tie into our last topic today, was the president was actually slightly strengthened in ways that nobody really expected. If anything, I expected him to get reelected but be weakened. So I don't know that it was a wave election. I think that what Mark's point is exactly right, is the political discourse needs to be adjusted to address the issues that what the growing majority of the voting public are interested in. And it's not liberal and conservative, because there are plenty of voters in a variety of those ethnic and other groups who might be more inclined to vote for a conservative candidate if that candidate is also talking about issues of concern to them. It's not, if you think about George Bush doing much better, for instance, with the Latino vote, because he was not perceived as being anti-immigrant and so forth. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done to figure out how does this play out, because these are not monolithic groups. You can't look at any community, Jewish, African-American, Latino, white, not white, whatever, and say they all vote this way.
That's it. Let me give you two major implications here. First of all, I think it diminishes the role of a presidential election in the policymaking process, because that, you know, this year we did see it so polarized along party baselines. Okay, so sure, the president won re-election, but you have 10 million people, 9 point some million people less voting. Okay, disaffected, maybe 2008 was an anomaly, but you'd like to have good participation. There certainly was at my polling place. But the way this really works is first through local government and then through the legislature. And that's where we're going to see the implications of it. But let me say, and it's going to affect the budget. It's going to affect the policies. It's going to be very difficult, I think, for the president to lead through that, because I think it's not clear to a central organization like the White House what the real policies are. What is clear is that you try to pander. I mean, this is government, right? You try to pander to those different constituencies, and that works best through the Congress. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get a budget deal. I don't think it's about the conservatives versus the liberals. It's literally about who wins and loses for the constituencies, and it's changed. All the discussions we had 2 or 4 years ago, it's different now. The second thing is, we're seeing the end of not really the Great Society, but the whole relationship between the federal, state, and local government in terms of funding and program delivery. The notion that the federal government somehow has a magic pot of money and can give that money to state and local governments and they'll magically give it to your local school district, that's gone. The demand for state government now for federal money is to bail them out for pension funds. And so you look at how so many of the block grants are set, and you look, we're just at the cusp of seeing this policy movement away from block granting and moving more to the federal government as direct service delivery. It is directly tied to the IT initiatives. There's no question about that. And you wonder, as America reshapes for these different demographic groups, we're going to see changes in funding to different programs. The critical question for me is, are we going to see a reinvention of the delivery channel where the federal government no longer needs to give money to state and local government? They deliver directly. And in that case, are we left with the federal government basically bailing out pension funds in state and local governments because the states, you know, many of the states just don't have the money?
Well, there's no question that that most of the most innovative delivery mechanisms are coming from the state and local governments, partially because they have been bankrupt and they've been having to figure things out that the feds haven't quite happened to get to. I mean, you see a tremendous amount of innovation at the state and local level. The only other thing to add here is that as we think about this reshape, and I agree with Mark entirely, that there's an entirely new voting public, or a very dramatically changed voting population, despite having a lower turnout this year than we did in 2008, which is odd given the lines. Where does that reflect itself on the policy level? And another reason to agree with Mark on his overall point is, if you look at the Congress, despite the change, there's no change in the House. Why? Because through gerrymandering on both sides of the aisle, we now only have about 5% of House districts that are competitive. And the biggest problem members of Congress have is worrying about a primary. And that inhibits their ability then to do anything kind of moving one way or the other, because they have to be watching their back all the time. And that can actually keep them from adjusting to this new reality that Mark's talking about.
It's a fascinating shift that we're going to actually probably start see playing out on Tuesday when the lame duck begins, even though the members that will be there will be the members not affected by the election. We will start to see the machinations, I suppose, pretty quickly. Mark Forman's most important federal news story of the week is from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is Vote Data Show Changing Nation. It's linked now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Stand Soloway's most important story of the week is next on the Federal News Countdown. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Are you shopping for insurance in the same place you go to watch cat videos? Don't spend hours trolling the internet looking for cheap dental or vision plans. Call the Government Employees Benefit Association. With GEBA, you'll work with knowledgeable representatives who understand the intricacies of your government benefits and lifestyle. Based on your needs, they can offer government employees, like you, basic and enhanced policies at competitive rates. They offer comprehensive dental plans that give members the freedom to choose a dentist they know, and also the ability to roll over up to $1,000 in unused benefits. With GEBA's vision
Vision Plan, members get the advantage of competitive rates with an extensive network of ophthalmologists, optometrists, opticians, and retailers, plus an annual pair of glasses or contact lenses. Open enrollment for dental and vision plans runs from November 12th to December 17th. For more information, visit GIBA.com or call 1-800-826-1126 to speak with a representative today and stop wasting time searching online.
Who has access to what, when, how, and why? Are users who they say they are? Who did what and when did they do it? All this should matter. Budget cuts continue. Identity fraud is increasing. Effective enterprise identity, credentialing, and access management are essential. HP can help. HP's Assured Identity Solution is a highly scalable enterprise solution that can be integrated with your existing systems that will amplify the value of the services you provide to your constituents. That really matters. Learn more at hp.com/go/get connected.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
Human Capital Management for the Federal Government is the most anticipated training event this year, featuring more than 30 participating Federal Human Chief Capital Officers and Chief Learning Officers. Don't miss this year's event, to be held on November 28th through the 30th, 2012, at the Sheraton Pentagon City Hotel in Arlington, Virginia. Check out the website, www.hcmfederal.com, for more information and to register now. Mention code HCMF for a $200 discount.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown with the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week it's Mark Forman and Stan Soloway. And Stan, your most important story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Savvy Strategy, Not Mandate, Key for Obama on Fiscal Cliff. I have to say, no disrespect to GovExec, because we use the term too, but I'm really sick of the whole term fiscal cliff.
There's a Facebook thing going to rename it.
There's a Facebook thing going to do everything.
It was one of the publications, Politico or somebody, has given it a new name. Someone called it base jumping.
What jumped out at this article, though, about you to you, Stan? What do you see? How do you see this shaking out?
Well, I think what the reason I pulled this article was because the headline and then some of the actual substance in the article, particularly Dick Gephardt's comments around the mandate question, there's always a risk after every election that any winner, no matter how narrow the margin, particularly in this case where the president actually did better than a lot of people thought he was going to do, potentially see it as a mandate. And I think former Congressman Gephardt's comments in this article are right on target, that it's not necessarily a mandate. And that this issue is it's not going to be as easy as the president saying, okay, I won. And this is what we're doing, which is kind of what he said today, which is I'm not surprised at, because the dance has just started. I mean, we've had the Speaker Boehner's comments and the president's comments. So the dance is just starting. But I thought it was interesting that during the campaign, you saw a number of Democrats using different language than the president. Some successful candidates talking about taxes on millionaires, not $250,000. So I think you're going to start seeing some negotiations over what level at which we're going to raise taxes, and it's probably not going to be 250. It may well be higher, 500 or 700 or something, at a level maybe where the Republicans politically just can't stop. But we're going to go through some pretty tough negotiations, and the dynamic that has changed is that the president's slightly stronger than we expected him to be, and a lot of people didn't expect that. The reality remains that I still think it's 50-50 that we're going to see some form of sequestration, minimally some down payment on it. And so the chaos and the lack of clarity and predictability that has bedeviled the agencies and industry, obviously, for the last year and a half or so is going to continue.
The part of this that I find the most fascinating, Mark, is the rising chorus of people who are saying, well, maybe this wouldn't be as bad as it's been painted to be. I know, Stan, you're not one of those people because you and I have talked about that before. But folks that, you know, are not rookies in the Washington game are saying, this is not pleasant. This isn't the way it should be done. But if it does happen, first of all, the world's not going to fall apart on January 2nd. And second of all, it may not be as terrible, especially if it's, say, later in January or beginning of February or something. A lot of folks seem to believe if it doesn't stretch out, that it might not be quite as bad as it sounds.
This is a salami slicer cut. It's got tagged with a bad terminology. From my perspective, any time you do budget reductions or budget agreements using salami slicer, it's a bad policy. Now, I'm kind of glad people are calling it fiscal cliff. On the other hand, the people elected, the same people who got to this determination, why should we expect anything different? The only people who have a right to expect something different are the people who elected somebody different. You know? Mm-hmm. That's the reality of this.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Keep in mind, what's changed also is people have begun to understand that it's not just about the spending side, it's the revenue side, because we have the Bush tax cuts expiring exactly the same time sequestration would go into effect. But to your point, Francis, I've heard some of that talk as well. And Mark's right, and I don't think anybody disagrees. In fact, some of the folks who say what you're saying would not disagree with Mark that it's bad policy.
Yes,
but maybe it's a shock
correct.
To the system we need and so forth. There's a third piece of this that I've heard a little bit of scuttlebutt about that is a little bit more Machiavellian, but makes me actually quite nervous because, frankly, political people think politically. And that is, to your point, if in fact this happens and the world doesn't end, and it's a little bit, it's not a cliff, it's a little bit more gentle downslope because there's a variety of ways that'll cushion it to some extent. The new Congress can come in and spend the next 18 months lowering taxes and raising spending because all of the Bush tax cuts will have expired. So even if you're just talking up to the middle class, they can pass. There's no disagreement about the middle class tax cut. And meanwhile, the cuts will be so deep in some places, as Mark said, the salami slice, they'll have no choice but to put some money back, whether it's into defense or into education or wherever it might be. So they can turn around and act as if they're heroes in the process by lowering your taxes and raising spending. So there's all kinds of weird permutations of this thing.
Look, there's the human nature, if you talk to the neuropsychology guys, says it's always easier to hand out candy than take it away. So I've talked about, you know, what I loosely call Foreman's paradox, right? That we're in a situation where there are reforms that need to occur, changes that need to occur, and they're painful, and they're risky. So naturally, it's hard to do that. There's very little incentive to do that, absent a crisis. And so you don't do it. You push it off. Well, things get worse, which makes them more painful, more risky. And so the way Congress has reacted in this since the early 90s, every one of the four budget deals during the time that I worked on the Hill and even after when in the 90s, was the only way you could get agreement was nobody do the hard work to take the pain. It's shared pain. And what happens, we know, is poor-performing programs stay poor-performing, and good-performing programs turn poor-performing. And how does Congress respond? More candy, a new program. And that's why I say the thing that you have to watch here is how does Coburn play that role? Because he's the guy that's been on top of this issue.
We're out of time. There's much more to discuss here, of course, and I wish we could do it. Most important federal news story of the week is selected by Stan Soloway, is from GovExec. The headline is Savvy Strategy, Not Mandate, Key for Obama on Fiscal Cliff. As much as I don't like it, that term is not going away. It'll be with us for a while longer. Stan, thanks very much for being here
always
today. It's always fun.
Always enjoy it.
And same to you, Mark. It's great to see you, and thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
Federal News Countdown is archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. All of the stories that we talked about are posted there too, so you can read them. And hour number two of the program is coming next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.